I speak to you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. I always have some technical difficulties when I'm here. I'm short. It's worse when I celebrate because all you see is the top of this bobbing head behind the altar. But it's not much better here preaching, so sorry over there. No, actually the worst was baptism when I couldn't get my arms over the font far enough and James had to rescue me. It is a real pleasure to be here this morning, and I sort of feel like it's been a while. It has been a while, so it's a joy to be here, and I'm going to be saying a little bit more about some of the things that James already raised in my sermon. I love and am challenged by this morning's gospel. I hear in it not so much the Isaiah passage set for today, but another Isaiah passage. And I realize that Isaiah is filled with talk about light, so it's not surprising. But the passage that I hear echoed in Jesus' word is Isaiah 42. These verses: I am the Lord, I have called you in righteousness. I have taken you by the hand and kept you. I have given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. Now, for almost 20 years, I've been gathering every week with one of the profs from the university, Paul Vimenitz, who's Jewish, and a group of students, and we eat together, and then we read theology together. And we've actually discussed this particular passage numerous times, because Paul thinks there's two ways of reading it, and that it's kind of critical that you reflect on that. So he said, is Israel a light to the nations as Israel, as a nation, or as individuals? Now, certainly for Isaiah, it's Israel is a light as the nation Israel. But since the destruction of the Second Temple and the diaspora, does that make sense anymore? Now, he did say, he points out, this could be an argument for the state of Israel. But that's not where he wants to go. He instead says, no, what this is about is that all Jews have a moral responsibility to be a light, which sounds an awful lot like what Jesus is saying. And so I actually talked to Paul this week about this, because I wrestle with this. What does it mean? What did Jesus intend for us in being a light to the nation? So I'm going to come back to those two options and suggest there's a third. Now, we've just heard last week the Beatitudes, the blessed are, all of which seem to just take everything and turn it upside down. And coming up, we're going to hear the you've heard it said, but I tell you, which is going to just seem to ramp up the commandments to the point where you think, oh my goodness, does Jesus really mean that? And in the middle, we get this incredible passage where he tells the gathered Israel, you are, in the words of Tom Wright, to be Israel. You're to be salt and light, both signs of covenant. And what does that look like? Well, he's just finished telling you it's about seeking justice and righteousness. It's, he will say, it's about forgiveness and about making peace. There's a wonderful commentary on this passage that said Israel was in this dilemma of what to do about the fact that they aren't a nation. So you think about what's happening at the time of Jesus. Israel basically has been under occupation for 500, 600 years by this point. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and now the Romans. So all of this talk about Israel being a nation is a bit difficult. It's problematic, shall we say, because the truth is other people are making the decisions. And in this case, it's now the Romans are making the decision. And their soldiers are in the street. And the symbols of the Roman Empire are everywhere. So you know you're not a free people. You're an occupied people. And so Van Driel, in this commentary read, said, look, there are three responses you see in Israel at the time. You have the Sadducees who collaborated. They took what they could get by collaborating with the Romans. And you have the Zealots who fought the Romans. And you had the sort of dominant response were the Pharisees, who said, look, Rome is corrupting. The world is a corrupting place right now. We are called to be righteous, and we need to preserve ourselves as a righteous people until God comes to establish his kingdom. And so they built big walls around the community and around the observance of Torah to protect their own righteousness. And I know we're all supposed to hate the Pharisees, right? Like, that's what you learn in Sunday school. Pharisees are bad, boo, hiss. I actually am really sympathetic to the Pharisees because I think the church often chooses the same approach. The world is kind of a difficult place. It seems kind of corrupting. So let's build walls around our community and around our practice and try and preserve our piety and our righteousness until God comes again. And we have this sense that what's going to happen is some place in the future, and we just have to hold out until the cavalry gets here. I think that is understandable. I also think it's wrong. I don't think that's what Jesus wants us to do. Because think about the options there. We don't want to be collaborators. We're called to be peacemakers, so that seems to sort of let out the zealot option. So if we're left then with the Pharisee option, okay. Well, what if there's another option? What if it looks a little different? Not because, Jesus says, he's done away with the law and righteousness as Israel has understood it. Remember, he's saying, I'm not here to do away with all of this. I'm not asking you to do anything new. He said, no, you're asking us to do it on steroids. Jesus is saying, look, I'm not asking you to do anything new. What's new is the time you live in. Because the law is fulfilled. And fulfilled is a code word. Every time you see it, what Jesus is saying is the kingdom is here. Not some far off future event, already present. And what does it mean to be righteous, faithful people if the kingdom is already present? Well, what are the signs of the kingdom? The imprisoned are freed. The oppressed are liberated. The hungry are fed. The sick are healed. And the dead rise. Why is it the first thing Jesus says to his people after the resurrection is, don't be afraid? Guess what, folks? Everything's changed. We live now in the kingdom. And as kingdom people, our righteousness now has an expansiveness, an abundance. Not to be kept behind walls, not to be kept as something that we're preciously trying to nurture until some future, but something that's just going to blast right out of those walls and blast right out of our community. Different image than salt and light. But think about that. Blinding light. I'm on Facebook, which is a bit like saying the Pope's Catholic. I love Facebook. kind of passionately love and hate Facebook, but the hating is like not real. Like, I just say it because that's what you're supposed to say. Oh, Facebook is such a pain. It just sucks your time. And you get all upset about stuff. Oh, that's nonsense. Facebook is awesome. I do most of my communication now in both the parish and the chaplaincy through Facebook. And on Monday, when we wanted to do something in response to the killings in Quebec City, we put it on Facebook and we had 300 plus people show up. That's the power of Facebook. Okay, that's the end of my little commercial break for Facebook, but I do love Facebook. I see all sorts of criticism of the church on Facebook. And this week, a friend of mine messaged me. She said, oh, I made that comment about white Christians, and afterwards I felt really bad because what if you saw it and thought I meant you and I didn't mean you? And I wrote back. I said, well, I didn't see it. So despite all the time I spent on Facebook, I'd missed it. But I said, but it's okay because I understand the criticism. I understand the criticism. But that's not my experience of church. I think the church has the same kind of issue that Paul talks about for Israel. Are we to be called to be a light to the nation as a nation or as individuals, or can I suggest a third option, as the church? Christians have often tried to be a nation. I'm just going to say, short form, bad idea. Every time we've done this, it has ended badly. Usually, frankly, with dead people. Not real crazy about the idea. The other option is to be righteous in the community, a light as individuals. And I think Christians have been as motivated as Jews to do that. To volunteer at the soup kitchen and the food bank, to get involved in public life. You think just even about who were key politicians in Canada and Alberta in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. How many of them were Christian clergy who got involved in politics, not because they thought the church should be in charge of things, but because they felt compelled as Christians to serve the community, to be salt and light. And as individuals, there's so much we can do. But there's so much more we can do as a community. So I hear the criticism of the church, and I'll tell you, I've been chaplain for over 20 years. I've heard lots of it, and a lot of it is heartbreaking. Often it's because the church has tended to be like those Pharisees. There's a reason why they're kind of the bad guys, because those communities became really rigid and law-bound and oppressive. There's a reason why Jesus talks about yokes and burdens. And the church often does that as well. In its desire to protect righteousness, does lots of this. I had a student who came to something I was doing, and he said he had actually been raised in the Anglican Church. He'd been confirmed. No, he hadn't. He had walked out of church when he had asked the priest a question in confirmation class, and the priest did this to him and said, you're never to ask those questions. Sit down. I don't want to hear that again. And he said, he walked right out the door. And he was now in his 40s, and it was the first time he had come back to a service. So we can do this lots. But I always want to say, and you know, I don't want to be defensive. So when people say about the church, I say, yeah, but look at all the exciting stuff. It's sort of the church that I know and live in. So I was like the chaplaincy. This was the initiative of the churches in South Alberta. At a time when chaplaincies were being cut across the country, the church here said, oh, yeah, no, we'll commit to this. Woohoo! And they've continued to support it. You've continued to support it. Pretty soon, like probably a couple of weeks, you'll be getting a notice in the bulletin, just a little heads up. We're going to be feeding students on our two campuses. So we're going to be doing a supper at the college, March 20th, save the date. And we're going to be collecting groceries for the university. And folks from this congregation have supported this. It is the most marvelous experience ever to see folks serving students. And when I first proposed this, people from the church sort of went gulp and said, "Can't they come here?" And I'm like, "No, you're going to actually leave your building. It's going to be really scary." And they're like, "Okay." So they came out to the college and they brought a church potluck out to the college. We do it a little differently now because Alberta Health sort of got on to us. But anyway, But people started coming out and volunteering at the campus and discovered it was actually fun to be on campus. And they enjoyed meeting students. And they sort of got a kick out of it. And when we hand out the groceries, we hand out 400 bags of groceries in 15 minutes. Because the students line up an hour ahead of time, because there are many students, that bag of groceries is carrying them through until they can go home. It is a powerful experience. And every so often, somebody from the church who's come and helped sort all the food and the rest says, "No, I can come on a weekday too and help." And we assure them we'll help them find parking. And they come and they're just blown away seeing this. What are they seeing? They're seeing abundance. They're seeing the hungry be fed. But more than that, they're seeing students loved on. Like, it's just the most wonderful thing to see people acting generously and abundantly to these students. Best thing ever. No, okay. Best thing ever is I now have little Syrian kids. Okay, no, this wasn't the best thing. They call me grandma. I got to say, my first reaction is, I'm not old enough to be your grandmother. And then I realized I'm the same age as their Syrian grandmother. It was really depressing. Anyway, I now have these little kids who call me grandma. And that has been the best thing ever. So we started this Syrian project. And I knew there were lots of people in the community who were concerned. And I was at the university at a meeting, and a prof I didn't know that well. We've become very good friends now, but I didn't really know her. She said, "Can we talk about refugees?" And my whole life was changed. And I was preaching out at St. Theo's. This was before I was the rector there, and the picture of Alan Curdy's body had been released that week. And so I preached on that. And as soon as I finished my sermon, the people who were popped out of her seat said, "I'm sorry, can I say something?" And I'm like, "Sure. We haven't had a priest for 4 years, and people have felt sorry for us. But do you know what? That means we have money now. We can do this. God's calling us to do this. So I think we're going to do this, right? Like, see me after church, but I think we're going to do this." And she said, "I'm really sorry." I'm like, "Preach it." And they did. And they committed a big chunk of money from their reserves, not knowing if they'd get a priest. They just decided this is what God was calling them to. And then, of course, they got involved and they started meeting our families. And then they started meeting the government-sponsored families. And now we have this wonderful collaboration between three Anglican churches, the university, and a group of doctors who just happened to be at the same meeting at Lethbridge Mennonite that we were at. And they said, "Well, we want to sponsor a family too." And Pastor Ryan Dewitt got an email. "I'm a student at the college. My family are in Lebanon. Can you help me get them here?" She had a big family, and we said, "Well, if all five groups work together, we can do this." The really neat thing about it, because there are lots of people, "Oh, it's a lot of money, and they're Muslim. We don't know anything about that." It's actually really simple. Halal sounds scary. It's not. You can even get halal chicken fingers that are really tasty at No Frills and pop them in the oven. So just a hint. I really like them. Just a hint. Can I say one of the best things about Syrian families. I call this my Syrian 10, kind of like the freshman 10, or baby Noor. They ask me more. I'm like, oh, baby Noor is just fine, thank you. What's come out of this has just been this incredible experience of abundance. All these fears that people had when we started, the fears about the financial commitment, the fears about this was taking us out of our comfort zone, have all disappeared, and what's happened is people have started welcoming more families.